From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to the Texas Observer Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. On this show, we really like to avoid, you know, general topics. Nothing too broad if we can help it. You know, that's why for this episode, we're focusing specifically on this tiny little issue called capital punishment. Involved in the discussion today is Observer contributor Alex Hannaford and adjunct professor at the University of Texas School of Law, Maury Levin. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Last week, The Observer posted a piece by Alex about death row inmate Larry Swearingen. Mr. Swearingen was convicted of the murder of 19-year-old Melissa Trotter, but decomposition science begs to differ. Point in fact, nine forensic experts took the stand at an evidentiary hearing for Swearingen to explain that he could not have committed the crime he was convicted of because he was already in jail at the time of Trotter's death. I'll let Alex briefly fill us in on the rest of that story.
So, Larry Swearingen has been on death row for the murder of a girlfriend a long time ago. And in February, there was a hearing in February and March last year that lasted. It was like a very, very long, kind of drawn out thing where these nine forensic experts got up and basically said, decomposition science shows us that the body was not in the woods as long as they said at the original trial. It could only have been there between 1 and 14 days maximum. And if that was the case, Larry Swearingen was actually in jail at the time on outstanding warrants, so therefore he couldn't have killed her.
Now, you go into a lot of very graphic detail about how decomposition science works at the start of your piece, but can you give us sort of like a general example of how you can date something?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of all very sort of CSI, but they can look at bugs and the different types of bugs and the different types of bugs that would happen to be out at that particular time of year. And then they look at the point where the bugs lay eggs, and they know that, you know, bugs take this long to do that, to gestate and the rest of it. So looking at the temperature and looking at the bugs and looking at the state of the body, they can find out. They've got a pretty good idea of how long it can have been there. And one of the things with this case was that the woman that was killed, her internal organs were fairly well preserved, and they're one of the first things that kind of turns to mush, you know, when someone's killed and left out in the open. So they were sort of Swearingen's attorney was saying that you know, that they were very, very they were in fairly good a fairly good state of preservation, and therefore she couldn't have been there as long as they said that she was.
So what was the result of that hearing?
So the result of that hearing was that the judge wouldn't make a decision because he wanted the full trial transcripts from the original trial. And so several months later, he still didn't have the full trial transcripts because apparently the court reporter hadn't produced them. And so he made a decision anyway. And the decision was that he was going to recommend to the Court of Criminal Appeals that Swearingen should not be granted a retrial. And it would be very unusual if the Court of Criminal Appeals, is my understanding, didn't take his recommendation on that.
Alex is looking at me. It would be highly unusual for the Court of Criminal Appeals, or the CCA as we call them, to not adopt a recommendation, particularly when it's a recommendation against relief by a trial court judge. This case is complicated, as they all are, when you get into the details, but it is important to understand it, I think, in what can be simplistic terms, which is all the scientists, or perhaps all but one, Texas experts who've looked at the evidence in the case agree. They differ on the precise date or time of her death, but they all agree that she was murdered at a time that excludes Swearingen as the possible murderer. And that very basic, indisputable fact is one that is in agreement across the board. So it is really incomprehensible how the judge came to the conclusion that he did. And I think that you make a point that is really valid, which is both that he didn't have the full record at the time that he made his recommendations, and also that he followed a path that many, many trial judges follow, which is to basically adopt verbatim the state's or the prosecutor's proposed findings. And that happens in 98% of the cases.
I thought what else was interesting was, you know, it leaves this huge question. I mean, you know, not wanting to, you know, you certainly don't want to kind of forget the victim in this situation. But of course, it begs the question, if Swearingen is innocent, who killed Melissa Trotter? And there's one fairly good way of at least trying to find out, and that's by punching the DNA that we do have into this thing called the CODIS database, which my understanding is it's a nationwide database of sort of DNA, DNA repository, if you like. And so, you know, maybe it would turn up nothing at all, but who knows, maybe it would identify somebody who could have been her killer.
And not just anybody can run a data through the CODIS. It has to be a government entity, and they are refusing to do it, right?
Yeah, Swearingen's attorney, James Ritting, told me that he had asked them to run this in CODIS, and he didn't know whether they had or not.
He just doesn't know.
That's what he said.
I thought that was that happened some time ago.
Yeah, he says, in my story I say it's unclear if the FBI has done so. James Ritting said he's asked them to do it and he's not sure if they have or not. And if they have, they haven't told him.
It is remarkable, and it shouldn't be at this point in my career, but there are an increasing number of documented cases of wrongful convictions here, and yet in the face of that, for Mr. Swearingen's case to be so blithely rejected is dismaying.
Yeah, there was something else about the story that really sort of got me, and that was this affidavit that a former colleague of Melissa Trotter's had sworn on, which essentially said that she remembers Melissa Trotter was working for this call center back in whenever it was, and she'd started getting abusive phone calls, and she'd let her colleague listen in to some of these phone calls, and in the affidavit, this woman testified that it wasn't Larry Swearingen's voice. She knew this because she went to school with Larry Swearingen. She knew Larry Swearingen. It wasn't Larry Swearingen. She assumes it was the same man, picked up Melissa Trotter a couple of times from her place of work. And some of the, I mean, there was threats to kill in there. There was some pretty nasty stuff. The outcome of that was in December 2008, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals rejected Swearingen's claims that the state had withheld evidence and presented false testimony during the trial. In particular, the prosecutors hadn't heard this testimony from this woman called Lisa Roberts.
There was a case out of the Court of Criminal Appeals yesterday in the Kathy Lynn Henderson case that we were discussing earlier, which maybe sheds a new light on Swearingen and may affect the CCA's consideration of the trial court's recommendations. And in Henderson, they granted a new trial, but it was on the basis of new scientific evidence. And the assertion and successful assertion that the evidence that had been presented that was pivotal to Ms. Henderson's conviction and death sentence, was no longer reliable in light of subsequent scientific developments. And on that basis, they remanded her case for a new trial. They didn't say that they believed that she was innocent, but they thought she should get a new trial. And that the logic of that opinion and the basis for the opinion certainly seems like it could be applied to Swearingen's case.
And not to mention the fact that she's been on death row for, 15 years or whatever it is. I mean, you know, that strikes me as something that's cruel and unusual. And there are several examples of this. There's a guy called Ronald Chambers that I interviewed a long time ago. And Ronald died of, I don't even know what he actually died of. Was it heart attack or something? Heart failure. Now, I remember saying to, when I interviewed Ronald, I said to him point blank, you know, did you have anything to do with the death of the person that had died in his case? And he said, well, I can tell you is I was there, but I didn't kill them. So it was the law of parties that, that pretty much put him where he was put. He was on death row for 30 plus years, 35 years, I think, in the end. 35 years on death row. And then he died in his prison cell without actually, you know, ever having that final appeal that could have come or whatever the last stay of execution.
And I represented Ronald at a certain stage of his proceeding when he got relief the last time, which is what I wanted to point out. He got, his case was released, reversed three times. And I mean that, three times. And every time they went back and they sought a death sentence again. And I can't remember the basis for the first reversal. The second one was a racist jury selection. It was a Dallas County case, right? They have infamously racist practices there. And then the last reversal was on the basis of a of Penry error, which is a well-acknowledged or well-accepted claim at this point, which is basically that Texas for a long time gave an unconstitutional jury instruction. So this man was unconstitutionally convicted three times and waiting finally for, you know, some kind of justice or some kind of constitutional proceedings, and he died in jail.
And this idea of new science is an interesting one, and I think over the last couple of years we've seen some very interesting developments which has sort of embarrasses the whole concept of, you know, the death penalty and sort of how it's meted out, because you've had Cameron Todd Willingham, there's a very, very good film called Incendiary that's made up about his case, but, you know, the New Yorker ran this huge story as well, which showed that fire science in that case showed, you know, fairly convincingly that he probably didn't commit the arson that killed his family. So that's, but he's already been executed, so it's too late for him. And then, you know, you have the Michael Morton case. He wasn't on death row, but, I mean, you know, Michael Morton exonerated through DNA evidence. And then you have Anthony Graves exonerated. You've been seeing all these DNA exonerations, and science is playing a part. And it, you know, how many more people are we going to see exonerated or huge question marks over their cases? And Murray was saying, you know, she had some involvement in the Hank Skinner case. I wrote a piece for The Guardian about this.
I'm not involved. I know the lawyer who
the lawyer who's involved. And you know, I made the kind of fairly provocative point in the Guardian story, which is that, you know, a DNA test is about $550. You know, so $550 is what could, you know, lead potentially to the exoneration of Hank Skinner. $550. But this guy was has been on death row for, you know, more than a decade. And he's been asking for this DNA, for DNA to be tested for, you know, God knows how long. I think they finally agreed, but
well, and they agreed, and there were preliminary tests that came back that, you know, the different sides have differing interpretations of. But frankly, the probably the most, they are seeking additional testing, but the most potentially pivotal evidence is would have been derived from a jacket that was found next to the couch where the female victim was found, and it, according to witnesses, I believe belonged to the uncle who is suspected to be the real perpetrator. Well, that piece of evidence, a jacket, we're not talking about a single hair or a single, you know, flake of skin. They lost the jacket.
Yeah.
And so, you know, all the other evidence, because of the facts of the case, the results of the DNA testing can be interpreted either way. They couldn't have been interpreted either way with respect to the results if they had been performed on the jacket.
Yeah.
And in that, and so we'll kind of, there never will be resolution, but that's because they lost the jacket. And that brings me back to, as I listen to you talk about Morton or Skinner or Willingham, or Swearingen, or, you know, many of these cases, they do share a common ground of new science. But what that has enabled us to see is the state misconduct that has gone on in every one of those cases. Because it's not just that they didn't know, you know, the science wasn't available, but there are, you know, the new science allows us to go back and look at how they got convicted, wrongfully convicted, and it almost always, and we could talk about it in each one of those cases, involves some form of misconduct by the prosecutor, hiding evidence, misrepresenting evidence. And so until there's an attitude that's more about seeking justice than getting a conviction, that will keep on happening.
Do you think that the egos come into play as well? And not only egos, but sort of, you know, careers are founded on this. I'm talking about prosecutors and you know, people involved in the prosecution. But, you know, these careers are founded on these big pivotal cases, death penalty cases. And so to actually concede that, okay, we might have, you know, this new science has evolved, we didn't know about it then, we couldn't possibly have known about it then, but maybe you're right, maybe we should do this now. There seems to be a reluctance to kind of accept that and to go back and say, okay, we definitely don't want to be wrong about this because this is a life or death situation. It seems to me that there's this sort of protectionism kind of, it's just a weird thing. And they're like, well, I don't want to, I mean, I'm nearing retirement, you know, this is my legacy.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. And for people, judges, district attorneys who are still sitting, they have to get reelected. So that's always on their mind.
Politics.
And I think you're right that it is a legacy thing. And I think that the approach initially, because capital cases by their nature are high profile and high stakes and highly charged in many ways, lead people to put on blinders. And then you're committed to them. And it's, you know, it takes a person who's really, you know, a big person who's committed to the truth to say, I made a mistake in a terrible situation. I made a mistake and I can't sound sorry enough. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what we see in Michael Morton's case is Anderson, the DA who prosecuted that case, who pretty clearly hid exculpatory evidence, is fighting tooth and nail. To say he did nothing wrong.
And the Kerry Max Cook case as well. You know, I mean, this guy has been, on scientific evidence, has been exonerated. But he took a, for various reasons, pleaded no contest. But Kerry Max Cook is a free man. He's been a free man for a long time. He's living out of state now.
But he's not
exonerated. Still fighting to clear his name. Still fighting for that exoneration. And, you know, as he says, he can't rent a house. He can't do all these things. And for him, it feels like he's still got a death sentence. And I mean, you know, I talked to Kerry only last week, and he's just desperate to clear his name.
It is brutal. And he pled out because he also was going back for, I can't remember, second or third, fourth retrial. And enough is enough.
Yeah.
You know, you know, he certainly is somebody who has, you know, knows full well the risks of innocent people being convicted and sentenced to death.
Yeah.
And he wasn't willing to face it again.
Right.
Anthony Graves is another, you know, extraordinary example of you know, obviously the injustice in the case and the misconduct and the experience and struggle that a person who's been wrongly convicted has even after they're out of the prison.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Anthony is somebody who has grappled with that with enormous grace.
Yeah.
And
Kerry, I mean, Kerry talking about that, I didn't even think to mention that, but the psychological sort of trauma that Kerry's experiencing now is just, I mean, you wouldn't even, it's just incredible. He talked, we did this, anyway, yeah, I could go off on the tangent there, but I won't. But I was going to say, you know, you made the quip at the beginning, Jonathan, about how, you know, let's discuss this very kind of small subject, capital punishment. But, you know, I can only sort of talk about the stories that I've covered and the people I've interviewed over the last, you know, 10 years. But it just struck me, I was saying to Murray when we first started talking that, pretty much without exception, every story that I've tackled, there's been an issue that I've kind of uncovered. And
right.
It's not necessarily, I mean, every journalist kind of course, wants the thing where they're going to find out that this person is probably innocent and it's this fantastic story. And people generally, readers like that as well. It's very black and white. It's a great story to have. That's not always the case, and it's often not the case. And I think Pamela Coller from Texas Monthly made this point recently. You know, often it's the sort of, it's the stories that the kind of nuances of stories that aren't that easy to tell, which are, in my opinion, actually the most interesting. And then, you know, so just sort of to throw out some names there, there was a guy called Angel Resendiz that I interviewed a number of times and corresponded with. He was known as the Railroad Killer. And, you know, back in the 90s, he would jump on the train and I think I may have even told you about this before, but jump on the train and jump up at random stops and bludgeon people to death. And, you know, definitely guilty. He was on death row for, you know, 7, 8, 9 years. And knew what he'd done, which meant that he could be executed because he knew that he was going to get the death penalty. But I remember the first interview that I ever did with him, when he told me he was this avenging angel from God and he was, you know, cleansing the world of gay people and pro-abortionists when, you know, even if that was his agenda, he would never have known who what the people he was killing believed at all or who they were because it was random acts of violence. He just went into a random house and killed them. And the thing that struck me there was that his lawyer was saying, execute my guy another day because he knows about other murders that he's committed that he wants to talk about and he wants to tell you and he wants to give you this information about. And they didn't listen and he died. And Resendiz told me about a few of these as well. He would come home, you know, covered in blood on numerous occasions. He told me more than 40 occasions he remembers coming home covered in blood. Had a hazy recollection about some of them. One case, and I may be sort of going off on off here, but I'll just tell you briefly. One case he told me about, he knew, he was very, very clear about where this happened. I couldn't remember the name of the town, but he was very clear about how it was bordering California and Arizona, I think, and there was a river, and he kind of was very descriptive. And I went back and looked on Google Maps and found out it was this town called Blythe, California. It could only have been this one place. And I phoned up the police station, there was only one police station in Blythe, California,
sure.
And said, I've just interviewed the railroad killer, and they obviously knew who he was. And I said, I think he may have committed some crimes in your area. And they said, oh, this is the first we've heard about this. And I said, well, how easy is it to look at missing persons records for between this date and this date? And they said, oh, it'll take weeks. And there was just no interest whatsoever. Plus the fact that he said that it was probably, he told me it was transients that he'd killed there. So probably homeless people. So we don't, you know, Resendiz was executed. We have no, I'm pretty sure that he was telling me the truth. Why would he make something like that up? That two or three people were killed in near Blythe, California. And we're never going to know. Ever.
It's pretty frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
It does make one question what the priorities are. I mean, and Resendiz, his case is exemplary of another really snarl issue within the death penalty, which is the mental illness and the death penalty and the seriously mentally ill who live there. And the people and the standard for incompetence to be executed and how that standard doesn't permit somebody like Resendiz to be exempt from execution despite the fact that he is clearly bonkers, was. We should be enormously concerned about people who are wrongfully convicted and who are innocent and on the row. But we should also be concerned about the injustices in the system that apply to the cases of those who are guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes to, you know, unconstitutional trials and racist prosecutions and a racist system and the inordinate representation of people who are severely mentally ill on the row and the lack of understanding and lack of compassion for those people and the extraordinary inadequacies of the system to deal with that population within the criminal justice parameters.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, why is it just if you've got a heinous murder, you know, and I'm just sort of plucking this out of the air, but if you've got a heinous murder where a white person has killed a black person, why is it okay for them to serve a life without parole sentence But for a similar murder where a black person has killed a white person, for that black person to be executed, there's no fairness in the system carried out. There's no justice in the way it's
going. And in fact, the injustice starts much farther back, because the number of people on the row who are there for, you know, as an African American killing a white victim are infinitesimal. And so it starts at the charging decision.
Yeah.
And there's even, you know, some evidence. Traditionally, it is the race of the victim that is statistically proven to be predictive in a offensive fashion. But there are some studies, at least for certain jurisdictions. There was a study out of Harris County a couple of years ago that showed that it was the race of the defendant that really predicted, made it, I forget the exact numbers, that, you know, much more likely that a black person, that they would pursue a death sentence against a black defendant. And if you just look at the stark numbers out of a place like Harris County, which, of course, Houston, which sends, you know, a third of the people on the row, is responsible for a third of the people on the row, there's a total overrepresentation of African Americans from that jurisdiction, proportion to the population, or the murder statistics. I mean, it's just stunning. Mm. And I was recently looking at, you know, the recent executions of people out of Harris County, and I went back, I don't know, 5 years. There were probably two-thirds more black people who had been executed out of that county than white, certainly than white, and I think white or Latino. And you could look at the same thing if you look at the lineup of people who are eligible for execution. It's appalling.
I mean, on a positive note, we're seeing less capital murder convictions. We're seeing less people sent to death row now. But what worries me is we've still got 400, however many hundred people on death row, and they're not slowing down the executions of the people that they are actually on death row.
That's right.
So, you know, I know there was a glitch recently with the whole lethal injection drug thing, but it didn't really sort of slow it down. We haven't got any more executions lined up for this year, but
what was the glitch?
So there was a lack of, basically they couldn't supply, or there was no supplier of the lethal injection drugs in the US. They were having to get it from elsewhere. And one of the companies was Lundbeck in Germany, I believe. And
Denmark?
Denmark. And an organization, human rights organization called Reprieve in the UK, were sort of very on the ball in sort of tracking down these companies that were supplying the lethal injection drug and saying, you know, to people, and you don't have the death penalty in Germany, so why is it okay for you to supply the lethal injection drug?
Well, I think the company Lundbeck didn't even know drug was being used for lethal injections, and you know, they were selling it to middlemen in the U.S. and they didn't know that it was ending up as part of the lethal injection cocktail. Mm.
And then in India, the same thing happened, which was interesting. It got on the front page of the Times of India, I believe.
It is, and what has gone on with the supply for the drugs that are used to kill people is a movie.
Yeah.
Because I mean, the question of the source of the drugs had not been raised previously, and then people, in looking at the constitutionality of the use of this three drug cocktail. The adequacy, the good quality of the drugs themselves becomes an issue, and then you start looking at sources. And some of the places that these prisons were buying drugs, strip malls in London, there was an infamous strip mall dude who, I think, like, had, you know, gave license, driver permits and sold a little drugs, lethal injection drugs on the side, and a company in India, and it has had a, you know, there are states that in some instances have been forced by the federal government to slow down. Judges have slowed them down. Texas, not so much.
Well, now we have the single drug, don't we?
Yes, the pentobarbital.
Pentobarbital.
And even that, so I've been involved in litigation around the lethal injection issue, and we do now employ, Texas, TDCJ employs a single drug protocol, and they do use pentobarbital, and pentobarbital was the drug that Lundbeck sold. So what TDCJ did was stockpile the drug before, when they started getting wind that it might get shut down. So they bought an enormous amount of the drug, and they're still using that up. The question of where they will go next is an open one, and I think that that's a question not just for TDCJ, but for all the prisons, all the
why can't they make, why can't we make it in the U.S.?
You know, it's not that we can't. It's, as I understand it, I think it's that we don't, and it it gets and it's, you know, kind of what's licensed and what's licensed for import, and there's various foreign countries that, you know, traditionally have produced these drugs, and now, as I understand it, a number of places are looking to the drugs that are used to euthanize animals, and so that means they don't have to kind of, it's a whole other black market, right? And it's, you know, it's a different set of regulations,
right?
And so, you know, it's obviously not something that we should be proud of. But the thing I think that's important to know and be concerned about in Texas, amongst many things, is that Texas is at the far right end of the spectrum as far as the openness of the process with respect to what they're doing on the drugs, where they're getting them, whether they're changing the protocol, how the drugs are administered, who's on the drug team, whether they're properly trained, where the drugs are kept, are they secure. They don't, you know, in other states, litigators, people who represent people who are going to be killed, have been able to get this information. We have not. And they, you know, it is, I use the word appalling a lot today, it seems, but it seems to be my general take on these things, that the fact that Texas, of all states, more, you know, carries out more executions than any other place, it does not feel that it is important to carry out that process in an open and transparent manner is something that should offend everybody, no matter if they support capital punishment or not.
I want to thank Alex Hannaford and Professor Maury Levin for being on the show. You can find previous episodes of the Texas Observer podcast, of course, at texasobserver.org. Thanks for listening.